Look, I'm intrigued by hardcore collectors. Where do they find the time? And don't they get to the point where they just don't want more stuff in their lives, weighing them down? I think more than a few house moves can inoculate you against collecting. I have a hint of the collector in me, I will admit. But obsessive collectors adore it. They can't help themselves. And now that they have, of course, online auction sites to help feed their addiction for curious objects of desire. And boy, are there some curious objects out there that people collect. Fashion designer and TV presenter Claudia Chanshaw is indeed a confessed collector maniac. In fact, Collectomania is the name of her new book. But of all the collections she documents in it, beautifully illustrated too, I have to say, I wonder if you can guess what her current obsession is. Welcome to the show, Claudia.
Thanks for having me, Natasha. Now the secret's out, isn't it?
It's about to be. Is there a fine line between collecting and hoarding, do you think?
It's more than a fine line. It's a chasm. It's an enormous gap. Yes, because hoarders have no order. So hoarders accumulate stuff that we would consider to be rubbish, like newspapers, jam jars, packaging, and it takes over their entire home. A collector has focus, so that while collections may take over their home, they're displayed properly, they're curated, they're focused. And the thing about a collector is they're proud and they want to share the collection. A hoarder's often ashamed of the situation they're living in, so it's quite a different thing.
A very different state of mind.
It is.
For any collectors who might be, well, navigating the collection process in their relationship, they can probably feel a little less guilty because, of course, collecting's been with us, you remind us, since we have been in existence.
That's right. Early man amassing pebbles and things like that. And, you know, the age of enlightenment when people from between the 15th and the 18th century were going out and collecting things from other cultures and creating museums, and that was really the beginning of our museums.
And I must say, I've always been totally attracted to the cabinet of curiosities.
The Wunderkammer.
I love it. I adore that whole genre of collecting.
It is wonderful.
Now, where did it start for you?
Mine started with Humphrey Bogart, and I blame my eldest brother for this. He used to take me to the Bogart festivals at the Academy Twin in Paddington, and I would sit there watching this guy, and I was 11, 12 years old, and I thought, this man's fantastic. I'm just hooked on him. You know, what's an 11-year-old doing in love with a dead actor famous in the 30s, 40s and 50s? So the first piece of the collection was a Humphrey Bogart poster, which cost me a dollar.
Well, that was a big expense.
It was. It was a little chipped and damaged too. So I said, I'll give you a dollar. So they sold me the poster. And from then, this is pre-videos and pre-tape recorders.
Indeed.
Video recorders. And so I had all these posters and books. And then I started recording the dialogue at the local cinema.
This intrigued me. You actually took a recorder to the cinemas with you.
I did. And in the silence, you did this click at the end of 45 minutes as I had to go and turn the tape over. And then I would, of course, recite all the dialogue and you know, I was an absolute bogey.
Why?
Mad thing. I think I just have that obsessive nature, and it didn't come out till I had something that I was fixated on. And then now I've since moved on, although I was watching a Bogart film just last night.
Well, there you go. So the obsession hasn't left you yet.
Not quite.
But now people call you Robot Girl. And you really are. Tell us why.
I have a collection of tin robots, and it's part of a collection of tin toys, so there are about 400 tin toys in the group. But the robots are the thing for me because they're either battery-powered or a wind-up 50s, 60s Japanese are the prizes, but going right up to the 90s. And it's growing up with TV. It's growing up with Lost in Space, the robot, the bubble-headed booby on there, and they're just fantastic because they're amusing. Some collectibles sit there and don't perform. These guys, you know, you wind them up or you pop your batteries in and you've got spinning pistons and guns bursting out of chests and surprising acts.
What I love about the whole tin robot thing, though, is that something totally captivates us about those naive representations of mechanized selves.
Absolutely. And the design hasn't changed. I mean, they've got pretty much, it's a square head with pretty dumb eyes.
What is that? Because we've entered now, truly, the era of robotics. Why are we still obsessed with these sorts of childlike representations of the mechanized you know, being?
I think it goes back to the original sci-fi idea of what the mechanical man looked like. So therefore your robot, although some robots these days are just spider legs and things like that on them, but your basic robot is a mechanical man. So it's still carrying that idea through, and they're sticking to the classic idea.
Mm. And of course, Japan was where they really took off, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
The 50s. What was it about the 50s? I mean, I'm thinking of Asimov and
you know,
the whole sci-fi fiction, sci-fi genre was taking off.
And also in reality, things were happening. You had the launch of the Sputnik, and that influenced films of the time. So you've got these amazing American films like, you know, The Forbidden Planet and The Day the Earth Stood Still. And the Japanese toy makers are looking at all this thinking, we can do this. We can do merchandise. So they started producing the most wonderful robots in the world. And I still believe the Japanese do it best. Mm. And they're still making them. Some of them are reissued based on original designs from the 50s and 60s.
Yes, I'll come to that. But the most expensive robot still stands at $74,000.
That's right.
What is that about?
Well, he's particularly rare. We have to qualify this and say not all robots are going to be that sort of price. But
A tin robot.
Auction, New York, Sotheby's, $74,000 for the Masudaya Machine Man. And he's part of a group, the Gang of Four, or the Gang of Five, because there's one missing. And particularly rare in its mint box, and that sort of price achieved, it has to have the whole box in perfect condition. And just there are hardly any of them. So for the diehard, super, super high-end robot collectors, this is the Holy Grail.
Mm.
And he went off.
Well, you've just mentioned that the Japanese are now reproducing some of their old classic robots. And this really goes to the core of all collecting, I think, and that is the tussle over reproductions and authenticity.
Yes.
Which comes up again and again in all the various types of collections you document in this book, from, you know, books to Bakelite.
Mm.
You're rather sort of open-minded about the whole reproduction thing, aren't you? You don't mind picking up a few reproduction robots.
No, I don't. They make up the critical mass, because if I had the budget, they'd all be 50s and 60s. But they're also not so easy to get, because, you know, some of these pieces are 60 years old now. So they have to have been looked after well and keep popping up. But no, I don't have a problem with reproductions, because understanding where the originals come from is a wonderful thing, and that is what I always aspire to, say, in the robot collection. But also, what it does is, as we all get older and the baby boomers buy up all the stuff that they couldn't have when they were kids, they become fewer and fewer. So the reproductions, which are beautifully crafted, most of them made in China now, like perfect reproductions of what went in the 1950s, it's a whole new market, which means my brother's children will grow up with these robots, and then in 30 years' time, they're going to be the next level of the collectible. So it really doesn't worry me. And with Bakelite jewellery, it's getting harder and harder
to
find.
Lots of Fakelite out there.
Oh, lots of Fakelite out there.
As you put it.
But with designers who are using contemporary plastics or working with old plastics in old ways, they're creating new jewellery. And again, it's a new realm of collecting. So yes, there is pure collecting, where you're going to collect only the original, which is wonderful, but don't close the door on it.
Actually, I think probably one of my favourite items in the book is a pair of Bakelite robot earrings from your own collection.
Yeah, they're my mum's from the 1980s.
Are they?
Yes.
And she, of course, was a famous fashion designer herself.
Absolutely.
And so some of her threads are in your collection now.
Yes, the Vivian Chanshaw collection's in the vintage fashion chapter.
Indeed. What is it about this relationship to objects and the quest to amass them? I just wonder whether sometimes there are other ways of seeking satisfaction in life than amassing material possessions. Sorry to be minimalist in the middle of thick of a conversation about collecting, but what is this impulse, do you think? Is it a nostalgia? Is it a sort of the kind of thrill of the quest of acquisition?
It's all of those things. For me, it's nostalgia, replacing toys that I sold as a teenager because I was too sophisticated and cool for toys anymore. And the minute I'd sold them, I regretted it. So my journey started as one of nostalgia, replacing what I couldn't have anymore, replacing what I loved and lost. It's a lot of it is nostalgia and looking back on times that made you comfortable and happy. For other objects like, you know, radios, that you might have loved grandma's home and that the sound of her Bakelite radio might have really been a warm and fuzzy experience for you. So as an adult, you go out and seek that and then become a little obsessive about that.
Yes, so I wonder if there's a slight neurosis caught up in all this.
Yeah, a good neurosis.
Unreconciled pasts and that sort of thing.
Yeah, but generally good associations, because people collect items, doesn't matter if it's, you know, first edition book or a Bakelite radio, and they're happy and it makes them feel good. And that's a positive side of collecting. I don't believe that, certainly don't know of anybody who collects something that they absolutely hate and that they have bad associations with. It's all about joy and sharing.
Mm, you can't take it to the grave though.
No, you can't. You can't. This is where it becomes a problem. I don't have any children. So I wouldn't like to be my family going through my stuff when I'm no longer on this world.
I think you'll have it well sorted and curated by then.
I think I will.
People collect all sorts of rather curious things, don't they, though?
They do.
I mean, I know last year on the show we had someone who was collecting, what was it, air sickness bags, and also we had someone who was collecting jaffle makers. So there are some, you know, that impulse is in can be terribly eccentric, but there is a vast community of collectors as well.
There is a grass community. And the nice thing is that because collectors like to share, then, you know, there's this whole network out there of the air sickness people or the, you know, the classic cars are a great example of that, where there are societies and clubs and, you know, swap meets and things like that, where people get together and they share information. And in the book, I have a lovely Rolls-Royce collector, and he belongs to several Rolls-Royce clubs in Australia and overseas. And the nice thing is that if somebody's going to move on a Rolls-Royce, the collectors and the club have first dibs.
Yeah.
So there's that loyalty to the whatever they're collecting as well.
I was right. Much collecting can be very much more personal endeavour, though. Some
Certainly.
People don't choose to make it a big splash in a collecting community. And I was rather touched by Barry Jones's collection, the
yes.
you know, great and, Australian and thinker and polymath, a politician.
And that's a solitary collection, because Barry is a collector of autographs.
Mm.
And some of the most incredible autographs you've ever seen. I've flicked through his scrapbook, and he has US presidents and most of the Australian prime ministers. And these are precious documents. I think he's got something signed by George Washington. And we said to him, you know, Barry, whose signature would you have if you could have anybody in the world? And he said, Jesus Christ.
And he means it too.
He does. It's a bit of a holy grail, unattainable.
But here's the thing. For all the thrill of the quest and the thrill of acquisition and sleuthing for something that you've desired to add to your collection, now it's all on eBay. So is that rather sort of diminishing the whole excitement associated with collecting, that you just get on a search engine, use your credit card, punch in the details and off you go?
It changes the way you shop. You still, even if you use eBay, you're still out there searching in the secondhand markets for that wonderful thing that they never realise the value. But what eBay's done, and I was very suspicious of it for a very long time, because I thought, I need to touch and feel, and do I believe what the person's telling me about the description at the other end? But after a few successes and getting to know particular sellers, what collectors do is they get to know the sellers and do then build a relationship with them online. I have bought some absolute doggies on eBay because I didn't concentrate hard enough, didn't do enough research, didn't look at the photos clearly enough. But what eBay also does for us is it gives you a very good idea of what's out there, and also gives you a reference for pricing. If you're curious about what something's worth, then you can have a look or see if something's really, really popular. Maybe you don't want it, you want something more rare. So
yes.
It does give us a good research resource.
The global marketplace that is collecting now. Although I do wonder, wonderful section on rare books as well. And
yes.
I just wonder, we're going digital. What's going to be left of our material culture?
I think the books are still going to stay with us. And I sincerely believe, having just created a book, the books are going to stay with us. It's still
yes.
the touch and feel and smell and the old friend sitting by the bed that you can dip into at night.
Yes.
I think the books are still going to hang in there. And rare books will become rarer.
Nothing like the smell of an old book.
That's right.
In my book. Claudia Chanshaw, lovely. It's a lovely book. May it smell good in 50 years' time. Thanks for joining us on Life Matters this morning.
Thanks, Natasha.
Claudia Chanshaw, obsessive collector, fashion desire, designer, TV host, you know her well, that wonderful bob of hers and those bright red lips, and her book is Collectomania. It's actually published by ABC Books. And coming up, well, a rather optimistic take on fertility gone astray.